Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. It's our first show of 2025, and it will be filled with smart people. It is time for another edition of the Science Forum. Our panel of experts back to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, 800-348-2551. Or email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. The number is 800-348-2551. 1, 2, 3 scientists in the house. We should be able to answer something. We'll be back right after the news. And the antiquated music tells you we're going back into Vox Pop. Welcome back. It is a Thursday here, first show of the year. Ray Graff with you. It's our science forum to kick off 2025. We have three scientists here. You'll find out who they are in a moment. But trust me, they're really bright. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question that you think a scientist might answer, and if it's Ed Stander, it'll be a snarky answer, but it'll be interesting. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or email, or phone, 800-348-2551. All right, we've done all that. Now let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
Hi, everybody. It's Barbara Brabets from SUNY Cobleskill. I am a biochemist, so I can handle biology and chemistry most days.
You're still on break?
Yes, we are. A couple more weeks.
How you feel about that?
I'm happy to be on break.
Yeah.
Wow. And just about ready to get started, getting ready for the next go around.
Ah, that's exciting. And then?
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist. I used to work at GE, but now I'm pretty much retired.
Good for you, man. That sounds good. And then you.
Snark, snark. Ed Stander here from SUNY Cobleskill. Snark, snark. And I teach geology, astronomy, environmental science, and whatever else I can pawn off
and
on.
And you do have a PhD in snark.
I have a PhD in snark.
Canadian snark, though. So,
it's not, 15%
it's like
less?
Snark light.
No, yeah. It's 20% less now.
Well, Jim, you told me something horrifying just before we got to the air here, and that you were reading a scientific journal today, and apparently nothing happened in science in the last year.
Well, nothing that excited me enough to bring the to bring it with me and talk about it on the air. Yeah.
So it was relatively low key year.
Low key year, I think.
But 25 is going to be filled with excitement, right?
Undoubtedly, yes.
All right, Barbara, you told me something that was kind of interesting. I'm not surprised by that, obviously, but I don't know where you got this. Speed of human thought is slower than your internet connection at home.
Well, my internet connection at home is slowest, so we're going to say the normal person's internet connection. But recently, some neurologists published in the journal, get this, Neuron. So, it must be about neurology.
Right.
And they called their article The Unbearable Slowness of Being. So I do have to give them A-plus for the snark title.
Mm-hmm.
But they estimated the transfer of information in the brain, not the processing speed, but the transfer rate, right, the moving from one portion to the other, is only 10 bits per second. That's the fastest we can transfer information from one part of the brain to another part of the brain, or from the brain to somewhere else, like my mouth.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
So the processing speed, like our chip size and chip speed, is different, but the transfer rate is slower than, by far, the transfer rate of anybody's modern device. So, for example, they equate, this is the New York Times, they equate like video downloads are at 5 million bits per second, and we're at 10, notice no million, bits per second in our transfer of information.
How can we function then?
Well, sometimes before coffee, I wonder.
I've actually been wondering myself around 2 o'clock every day for the last couple of weeks. But no, seriously, I mean, that's a very slow data throughput rate.
So unfortunately, it means that, you know, when we step on the brake because we see a deer crossing the road, right, that whole response system is really hardwired. And I'm sure we can improve it, but we can't improve it probably in orders of magnitude. So I think fighter pilots, you know, there's other people who work doing repetitive tasks. They can get very fast at stuff because you can build new networks to kind of accommodate that particular routine. But, you know, sorting socks when I do my laundry is going to take as long as it takes me to process that information and then get that information to my hands. Right?
Well, it gives you a lot of time to think about it.
It right? sure does.
I mean, many times I wish I had, for example, a way of putting my email into a special box so I didn't send it right away so I could think about it a couple times before I sent it. So it's
lo and
a good
behold,
thing to
they
have.
Do have that, but...
It's interesting to me. Now, I'm trying to figure out how then we exist on a daily basis. If what you just said is true, and I understand it correctly, then most of the things that we think we do very quickly are actually hardwired. We're making connections and networks of neurons in our head. So it's quick, 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 quick.
Or even don't require the central nervous system to process. So like you put your hand on a burner and it's hot and then you have the reflex back. That doesn't require a lot of processing power because there's a reflex that happens that doesn't have to go through a lot of processing. There doesn't have to be over to the brain and then back, right? Muscle twitches, blinking. Oh, blinking sometimes does, right? Oh, everybody's blinking at me now. There are autonomic reflexes and reflexes that are intentional. So they kind of travel in different measures.
Yeah.
But I think what it does show us is that we don't have good multitasking. Like if you think about it, 10 bits per second is pretty lame.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to do multiple things, like look at your cell phone and drive at the same time, you're probably shorting one of the two. And I would hope you're shorting the cell phone and not the driving. But I think it shows that multitasking is a bit of a myth.
Yeah. The other part of it, though, is your brain has got neural highways where thought processes are a lot faster because you've done them so often, such as things that are involved with muscle memory, for example.
Yeah, like typing.
Like
or
typing.
Or piano
playing. You can be much, much faster than that because you're so used to doing it. The signal goes from one end to the other directly.
But it still requires thought? In other words,
yes.
But does this shed light on why reflexes are so important or maybe that they're more important than we're given to believe?
I think that that's what these researchers were trying to find out, right? Because the next question will be, okay, so if the processing power is as slow as we think it is, or they think it is, on average, how do you improve it? How do you bypass that kind of trunk of information, speed, backlog, and get around that? And then ultimately, are the AI bots of the world, do they really have to be as fast as they're going to be if we're trying to simulate a human? Maybe not, because we might not need that same processing speed in an AI bot if it's trying to perform a task at human speeds.
Yeah, because you look at it, if you try to do something that you've never done before,
yeah,
and really have to think about it, you can almost count the little clickety clicks in your brain as you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
So I can buy that under circumstances in which you really have to process new information, think about something hard, that it's going to be pretty slow.
And we also have good days and bad days for this kind of neural transfer. Like I can feel a day when I'm running at, 110% as opposed to 90 or 80%. It's not always about sleep or whatever. Sometimes it's just about the mood, right? How good, especially with typing, I can find like certain, I'm a pretty fast typist. And then other days I'm like a supreme typist. I'm like, wow, where did that come from? And then other days I'm just kind of like a bunch of fingers that don't know what they're doing.
How did they actually measure this?
They did it. Let's see if I can explain it too much. Not too much.
Slowly,
really.
Slowly.
You have 3 minutes, so go ahead.
10 BPS. I'll do it. They looked at how quickly people carried out certain tasks, just like we're talking about. So they would give people a word. They had to recognize each letter of the word and then sort out the sequence of keys to press in order to perform that action. So maybe it was like take a bath. I'm just making this up. This might not have been in there. So then you have to key in what sequences of things that you have to do to take a bath. And so it's not just repeating what you're hearing, which can be very quick. Like think of those two-factor authentications we get on our phone, right? I don't remember those, but I can look at it. I can kind of say it once and then type it again.
Yeah.
Not much processing power there, but I'm just kind of doing it. I'm certainly doing it at slower than 10 BPS too. But anyway, but if I had to write down what it takes to take a bath in words then or say it out loud, then it's going to take some processing to go through the list in my head and then express it outwardly, either by writing or by saying. So
the whole thing, I mean, how many people, were they all dopey? Were they exceptionally brilliant?
They took everybody, yeah.
Well, how many is everybody? Well, they didn't ask me.
Well, in Finland, they had 168,000 volunteers to do something similar, but they used typing. So they asked them to type certain phrases, and then the fastest typers were 120 words a minute, and then on average, and then you've got like the peckers, you know, with the people with one finger at a time, and then on average, people typed about 50 words a minute, and so they kind of used that as a benchmark of how fast people could type, and then you're still, even if you go to 120 words per minute typing, you're still only doing it at 10 BPS. So even the fastest typists are still processing at that same
And you're
power.
A touch typist.
I'm a touch typist.
Ed, are you a pecker?
I try to be, yes.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's our number. It's the Science Forum. If you have any questions at all that science might help answer, otherwise, you're going to get more of this. So give us a call or email voxpop@wamc.org. John Schofield on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum, our first Vox Pop of 2025, and we have the usual suspects with us today, Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett as well, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. All right, here's a question from Stephen Longmeadow. Why does the sound change when the hot water actually becomes hot after we turn on the hot water tap in the kitchen? In other words, you can tell when the water has become hot by the sound and don't need to feel the water itself. And that's from Steve in Longmeadow. Don't all jump at once.
No, we've had this before. I just don't want to pick the wrong direction.
Wow.
So what happens is it's hitting a surface like the stainless steel. Usually it's like a stainless steel sink. Or like in a plastic enclosure for a shower, and it's the sound of the heat change. The temperature of that surface is changing, and therefore the echo changes when it hits, when there's an impact. So the plasticity of the plastic or the plasticity of the stainless steel is going to be slightly different. And so we can hear that pitch difference if we have that surface heated up. It's not actually the water per se, but it's the hot water heating that surface that it's hitting.
Interesting. Anybody else?
And we need another engineer in the room who's not here today to be able to tell us which way is it. Is it the frequency going down, I think? I think the pitch goes down.
The frequency should go down.
Yeah, because it's getting hotter.
Here's an ancillary question that came up from watching a beer commercial over the weekend or over the holidays sometime. So there's a bunch of bottles on a table and somebody's playing a Christmas tune and the last tune is sharp and they fill it up with a little more fluid and then it's right on pitch. So I got this question and I'm going to ask Ed because you do the thing with the glasses and the sounds. So my question was this. If the amount of a fluid or whatever, the volume, changes a pitch. Is it by volume and mass, I guess, or is it by ratio? In other words, if I have a half-full bottle here and it's A440, and then I have another bottle, but it's twice as big, but it's the exact same ratio, is that a different octave of A?
Well, the note that you get depends mostly on the mass of the bottle. okay? And if you add water to it, what you're doing is you're increasing the mass through coupling of the water. You get the same thing with the glasses. If you put water in the glass, the sound goes down. But if the water has bubbles in it and you get bubbles forming on the edge of the glass, then the sound doesn't change or changes very little. It buzzes more than anything else. And that's because you're not increasing the coupling mass of the glass.
So then we couldn't, just by looking at the ratio of fluid to bottle, tell what that pitch is?
No, it depends more than anything else on the thickness of the glass in the bottle. And then the water can change it somewhat, but not very much.
Can you tell I had a very exciting holiday season if this is the sort of thing I'm thinking about?
If you're drinking beer and trying different levels, I can understand that.
Well, and I have follow-up questions, so that tells you how exciting this is. So, Ed, when you're building your own glass harmonica, because it's not really a harmonica, but a glass setup, you pick these glasses by that their masses approximate a certain note, and then you fill them just to kind of key in the note. Is that it? Because I've seen your setup. You've got all different size glasses that are there.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've got like cognac snifters, and you've got kind of like, I don't know, like a cheap wine glass you'd find on an airplane. And
right. Well, the most important part of the glass to adjust is the top of the rim of the glass.
Mm-hmm.
If the rim is very thin, then you get a lower note. And the bottom of the glass, where it's sort of like a bell, effectively, that makes it work. And so people who do this actually grind the glasses to get exactly the right note if they want to. What I do is I audition glasses. So I would go into a store with a little chromatic tuner, and I'll try hundreds and hundreds of glasses and come out with three of them.
How many stores have you been kicked out of? That's what I want to know.
Well, you know, they like me going there.
Why?
Because, entertainment section in the housewares.
No, it's not just that. But if the glass is broken, if it has a small crack in it or something, it buzzes when you play it. And so I can go through all their glasses and find all the broken glasses before somebody buys them. And so they've got no problem with me doing it.
So if there's still a show by the end of 2025.
Yeah, I'll bring it in for you.
We should do it again. I know you've done this in years past, but that was a fun.
Well, I know the engineer had a hissy fit when I came in with these
did
glasses
Zach
filled
get
with
upset?
Water. Yeah.
Zach, when Ed brought in the glasses to do the little mini concert, were you upset? You didn't ever said anything to me about it. No. He doesn't remember. Well, okay.
Then we can do it again.
I vaguely remember it, and I'll tell you all about it later. This email from Peter in Barryville. I live in a log cabin with what I'm informed by my wife is an open floor plan. My wood stove sits in that part of the cabin with a vaulted ceiling above it. Consequently, the majority of the heat produced by the stove rises to the rooms on the upper level of the house. I have a paddle fan about 10 feet above the stove. What is the better position for the fan to turn? Under normal circumstances, with an 8-foot ceiling, I would want the fan to pull the heat toward the ceiling, where it would then be pushed down. But in this case, with such a high ceiling, should I have the fan circulate in the normal summer position, pushing the air down?
I have a similar setup, and we do have the air pushing down. The problem is if the wood stove's off, sometimes that can give me quite a chill down my back, because we don't have the hot stuff up there yet because the wood stove's been off. And so you don't want to leave it on all the time. They even make a thermostatic control so that the fan will kick on and push down that air when it hits a certain temperature, say like 75 or 78,
uh-huh.
so that it's not on all the time, kind of like just moving the air around. The other thing you can do is if he has another heat system in his house is he could just turn the heat system fan on but not the furnace. So if he has like hot air for his house, he can just have the circulating fan move that air around the house. It gets to every room and really does a better job of mixing than the ceiling fan will. You really need a big ceiling fan to move that much volume.
The biggest problem is if the air is pulled up, then what it'll do is it'll go up, it'll run along the attic and then go down the sides of the building. And if you have windows in there, then all that air comes down is going to wind up getting cooled by the windows before it gets down to the bottom, and you'll get even more drafts.
Mm.
So really what you want to do is have the air push downward and then go up along the windows. It's one of the reasons, for example, in normal houses, if you have a window, you've got a baseboard heater underneath it to stop that draft. But if you have the fan on there pushing the stuff down, you'll have even more draft.
Interesting. Jim?
No, I don't think I have anything to contribute.
All right, fair enough. Well, maybe we'll put that in that science journal.
Yeah,
another thing that didn't happen. 800-348-2551. That's the number. It's the Science Forum. Email is voxpop at WAMC.org. We'll get back to the email shortly, but let's go to Hudson. Austin, you're on.
Hey there. Happy New Year, everybody.
To you.
So I'm afraid I'm too ignorant to actually repeat this thing that I heard a couple years ago. I'm hoping if I get far enough down the track, you can take the baton. So there was a geneticist on a podcast who was a guest speaker, and he was talking about how at 11 generations, that is as far back as we can go where we're technically still related to somebody because of the length of the genomic sequences that are still in our DNA at that point. That's about as far as I can take it. I'm hoping that that just gets us anywhere where you guys can shed some light on something I just thought was very interesting a long time ago.
Okie doke. What do we have, scientists?
Yeah, 11 generations. Because so with normal birth and procreation, we'll just keep it humans. We're not going to do bacteria, anything weird like that. Because we're related, but we're not that related. Anyway, every time there's a generation, you're inheriting half from one parent and half from another parent, right? And it's a bit of a mashup of the parent genes. You know, each parent has two sets of genes. You're only going to get one of those genes, but it's not like you get the mom's mom set. You get some of the mom's dad and some of the mom's mom. There's a mixing that occurs. But because you're doing that, if you even go four generations out, you only have 2% of even your great, 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 great grandparents because it's half of a half of a half of a half. So if you do that at 11 generations, then the scatter of the genetic drift, as we call it, or the genetic mixing is about the same as the regular population. So that's why it's just the math of taking a half and then multiplying it by a half and a half and a half. Again, eventually we get down to a really small number.
But what about the matrilineal mitochondrial DNA?
Yeah, that's different. So, and there's two things. First off, 11 generations ago, there were a lot fewer people on this planet. And so one of the reasons why that doesn't quite, why the math doesn't quite go the way I've described it is because there's crossover. So not in the mitochondrial sense, but in the sense that your aunt on your dad's side could have also been your aunt on your mom's side way back generations-wise because there weren't that many people. And so you're going to have kind of family trees that interweave when you go back that far, especially when we had societal pressures to stay within our class or to stay within our race or to stay within our religion. All of that stuff really does exaggerate that 11th generation business. But as far as the mitochondrial DNA, the DNA I have in my mitochondria come from my mom and my mom only. The sperm doesn't deliver that, and that stays with anybody who's a progeny of my mom. And so my mom's mom's DNA in her mitochondria is the same as my mom's, is the same as mine, and if I had children, the same as my children. So there is a matrilineal line of mitochondrial DNA with much less what we call drift. So there's no mixing of mitochondrial DNA. If the only mixing occurs from genetic errors that occur during processing.
Mutations?
Yeah, mutations. Like, not in a bad way, but kind of like just, you know, an error every once in a while, right?
Right.
And so we can follow the genetics of matrilineal lines back quite a bit, and there's like a haplogroup that everybody has from their maternal mitochondrial DNA. If you do any one of these genetic tests, it'll tell you who your haplogroup is, like who's your mitochondrial Eve. As they call it, yes.
Austin, go ahead.
Then it's a similar thing with the Y chromosome for males.
Because the Y chromosome you inherit, your 23rd chromosome, the Y version of it, you only inherit from your father. And so your father's 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 father has a similar path. So you can do the same if you're male. Okay. I don't have any Y, so there's no Y tracing for me. But I do have a brother, and he's done his Y tracing, so we know that.
Austin, we're going to be sending you a test on this a little later on. Did you get all that?
I don't stand a chance. Thank
all right.
You so much.
Just multiply a half by itself.
Half
to the 11th power, and then you'll see the number's really small.
All right, Austin, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum today with Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. And let's go to Betty in East Durham. Betty, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon. I have a question about radio waves. Are they all around us, even in areas without industry?
Basically, yes. Yeah. There are some spots that are particularly quiet and deliberately kept so, But it's in West Virginia, right?
Yeah.
Where there's a, there's a radio observatory.
Yeah, radio silence zone there, yeah.
And that was put there because the mountains helped block a lot of the radio waves.
Yeah. But in general, radio waves are pretty much everywhere. And in fact, radio waves
come from space. Yeah, all the time, everything. Stars.
The only really quiet place is on the part of the moon that faces away from the Earth.
From our generated radio waves. They'd still get the cosmic radio.
Yeah.
What do you think, Betty? Are you scared?
No, not at all. I was just wondering, when I pressed my garage door opener, it's just so amazing that just instantly it opens, and how quick that they travel. They must be very quick waves. That's all I could think of. And I wondered if they were all around us, and if I went into the woods, and are they in the woods or on over the ocean? And
well, they don't travel forever, right?
A random thought.
Yeah, they don't travel forever. I mean, they run at the speed of light because radio is a type of light. It's just light that we can't see, and we labeled it such. But they don't propagate forever. They can hit a surface and then be absorbed by that surface. So your garage door opener is not probably bouncing to the moon. It's probably getting absorbed by the materials that are in and around your house.
All right.
And
of course,
can I ask one more thing? Is the music that we play, or if it's outdoors or at a concert, what happens to all the sound? Does it go into the ether, or what happens to it?
It will be absorbed by the atmosphere or any solid object and end up as heat.
As heat?
Mm-hmm. As heat.
Yep.
So it's just warming things up a little tiny bit.
Yeah, because they're just basically little boom, 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 boom. So they're like little pressure waves that we interpret. And, you know, even the ones that hit our eardrums are flexing our eardrum, and then they're dissipated. Uh-huh. And then we have a nerve that gathers that information and translates it in our head into a sound that we can interpret. But
right, which is
they're
why,
really just percussive waves.
Yeah, it's why when you tell somebody that they're full of hot air, they effectively are.
There you are, Betty. Hey, Betty, thanks.
I got it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Have a great day. Appreciate it. Of course, underwater, it's much, if you're in the ocean or under the water, it's tougher to get signals through, right? Based on...
Depends on the frequency.
ELF,
yeah,
very low frequencies will go further.
Yeah. Right. That's why they've this whale language that we've discovered, because now we're reading the very low frequency emanations from whales. And we realize that, A, they are talking to one another in their own language that we can't hear. We can't hear it without devices. And that these can travel hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, so that they can communicate over rather long distances through the water. It is amazing. And it's like, do they like talk about like YouTube videos with cats on them? Or like, what is the, do they do weather reports? Like, we haven't yet got the skills to interpret what they're saying, but we do know that they are communicating back and forth.
And they have enormous brains.
It's not just that as well. It's the fact that they have actually discovered that there are places in the ocean where sound travels better. For example, you have slight changes of density in the water.
With salinity, more saline, less saline.
The sound stays within those ranges and goes for very, very long distances.
I did not know that.
So it's like an echo chamber for this information. And there was this, I was reading about this one whale. This was cool that I read this year. This one whale was a Pacific Coast whale, but then he traveled to the Indian Ocean. And his, and they kept track of his language, if you will, what he spoke, for lack of a better word. And his dialect changed when he approached the Indian Ocean because there's a dialect of whale there,
that
they believe.
Amazing.
And that he was bilingual enough to have like Pacific Coast California whale and then also Indian Ocean whale, and that he was communicating back and forth trying to find a mate.
And
that's
if anybody has the question, maybe they will, how they talk underwater, it's because they have holes in their head.
Mm-hmm.
They have a large area inside their head which effectively is empty.
Reverberation.
Which allows them to talk effectively into that area, which then acts as a speaker to travel the sound long distances.
So there are actual vocal cords involved, but it's not going into the air until it hits this
resonating channel. It doesn't go in the air at all,
channel.
Actually, because it's going into the water.
I think we've probably all been in pools as kids and tried to make sound, and the sound just doesn't propagate very well.
We're not good at it. Yeah, we're terrestrial animals, that's for sure.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today with Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. This is from Holly in Wagontown, Pennsylvania. Mm. I wonder how it's 2025 and we still can't see the lines on the road when it rains. What is the science of why this is the case? We could walk on the moon, live in space via the space station, cure diseases, etc., but we can't develop paint for roads that is highly visible in the rain. And that's from Holly in Wagontown, Pennsylvania.
I ranted about this very thing.
Really?
I understand why. It's that basically the highly reflective paint has retroreflectors in it, things that are corner cubes that...
I'm sorry, what?
Well, they're called corner cubes.
What are they?
What corner cubes are, well, it's like looking in the inside of a cube. What it does is light will reflect off three of the walls and come right back the direction that it went in.
How small are these corner cubes?
They can be very small.
Yeah.
So
that's nuts.
There's little particles in the paint. Well, it's the same, you know, for example, the road signs that look so bright when at night. They have the same kind of retroreflectors in them. Now, the issue is that it works only if the light gets into the little corner cubes and gets reflected back in your eye. When there's water on top, the light bounces off the water and goes off into space and does not come back to your eye.
Amazing.
So the only way really that you can see something like that at night is that if it's actual reflectors that stick up above,
which is what they do now in Canada and other places.
Yeah.
But apparently not in Wagontown, Pennsylvania.
Right, and it's really hard to snowplow a road if you got stuff sticking up. So, when I went down south as an adult before, and I saw like these reflectors that were sticking up in the middle of the road, I thought this is the greatest. I can see regardless of the rain or the snow, I can see it. But then they don't have people plowing their roads, so otherwise they'd knock all those reflectors right off.
Cool. Yeah. All right, so we'll take a break here, and then we'll get back to the calls and the emails, 800-348-2551 if you want to call in, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. It's the Science Forum. We'll be back. Steely Dan, Asia, here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. If you want to call the Science Forum, we have Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett and Ed Stander here to answer your questions. A couple emails here, voxpop@wamc.org. Here's one from Kay. When, say, a bell is struck with a stick here on Earth, some of the energy resulting from the force of the strike propagates as sound waves. Now, if one was to strike a bell in space or any vacuum, I assume the strike would result in the same amount of energy being released, but not as sound waves, correct? And if correct, what form would the resultant energy take? And that is from Kay.
Do you want to do that, Ed?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. because the energy can't be dissipated as sound waves, it will just reverberate in the bell until it, by the dampening...
So physical energy?
Yeah. But eventually, because the bell isn't perfect, it will dissipate that energy as heat.
Okay.
So, a vibrating bell that makes no noise.
Yeah. So then either it will radiate then that heat away as infrared radiation in space.
All right. This one is from Jeff. I have a liquid citric acid cleaner. I'm trying to match it with a powdered citric acid. Is it simply a matter of adding the powder to water until the pH matches?
Pretty much.
Yeah. pH, though, isn't a good indicator of the concentration of the citric acid. That's because pH really isn't very sensitive to how much of the stuff that's in there. It's the amount of ionization. Plus, it's a logarithmic scale.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. So it's...
If it's one pH unit is 10 times more or 10 times less the concentration. So
right.
It's a big deal.
So but it's like the Richter scale.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's just... So chemists do not measure the concentration of acid with a pH meter.
But if he's trying to get a cleaner, then trying to match the pH is probably good enough as long as he wears protective equipment when he's making it. Usually it would be sodium citrate or potassium citrate, which would be the thing that you start with, and then you'd add water to that. It doesn't quite... It's not citric acid. It's citrate, which is its kissing cousin. But you can probably get there just by adding water.
But that would be a basic cleaner.
I don't want to do pKa on the radio, but the Ka citrate's like 6.7 or something like that. It's not very acidic.
Yeah.
So
why don't you want to do pKa on the radio?
It's okay. The smaller the number, the more acidic it is, and the closer to 7 you are, the more neutral you are. Yeah. So citric acid's not terribly acidic, even though we think of
actually citric acid is. Pretty acidic.
But a citric acid cleaner.
Citric acid cleaner is going to contain citric acid.
Plus citrate, usually. It's a buffer.
Because you want it acidic to remove the deposits that...
The lime, et cetera.
Yeah, that will be soluble in acid.
I stand corrected. If I used Google, my friend Google, commercial citric acid cleaner has a pH of about 3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551 if you have a science question, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. This is one from Dwayne in Rotterdam. Dwayne writes, it's a question related to audio perception and hearing. I tried to replicate this a few times, and I can't, but I know in the past I've yawned, and whatever I was listening to, music or songs, playing had a deeper pitch or changed octaves at a certain point at the peak of the yawn. What causes that? And that's from Dwayne in Rotterdam.
Your mouth is a Helmholtz resonator.
What?
Ooh.
How do you like that?
What do you mean?
Like he's swirling.
You know, when you take a conch shell, for example, and you listen to it at the ocean, you hear the ocean roar. It's because the sound is amplified based on the size of the volume of the conch shell. You can get the same thing out of any container. If you take a water container, for example, put it up to your ear, the sound will sound deeper. Well, when you open your mouth, what's happening is the sound's coming into your mouth, and it's actually amplifying the deeper sounds depending on how big your mouth is. And so you wind up getting a very, very different sound. One thing I do when I'm playing glasses very often is I'll take a singing bowl, and I'll give it a hit, and then hold it up to my mouth and yawn. And you can actually hear the pitch of the singing bowl change,
that
go higher or lower
amazing.
As the sound goes into your mouth and then comes out.
And what's the name of the resonator again?
Helmholtz.
And so is this the same thing that the whales we spoke of earlier are using?
It's effectively the size of their head cavity is
the
Helmholtz resonator. Yeah.
I think there was a dinosaur, I think Pachycephalosaurus, that had
a big thing.
And they theorized that this had something to do with sound.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So fascinating. All right, let's see. Let's go to Wi-Fi here. This is from Tom, 800-348-2551, if you want to call in with a science question, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Tom writes, I have dead zones for Wi-Fi in my house. Son sent me a new booster for Christmas. Should not be on the opposite side of a thick oak door, as that prevents signal from getting to booster extender. I want to put it on the other side to get dead spots.
To clear up the dead
spots. To clear the dead spots, yeah. So, you know, you can try it. Like, if you can't get... So what I would do is put the extender in a place that you know will connect to your original Wi-Fi so that you know the extender's working. Then take that extender and then move it to the other side of the oak door, maybe with the door open. Plug it in. Usually these have to be plugged in. And then see if you can connect to that extender Wi-Fi and then close the door and see if it works. We have one in one of my family's house where if the washer lid is up, you cannot get the Wi-Fi extender.
Oh, man.
So if Netflix goes out, usually the call to the other part of the house is, put the washer lid down.
That's too much. All right. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email. We have Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, and Jim Pickett here on the first Vox Pop of 2025. It's the Science Forum. Jim writes in, We in the scientific community laugh at those who believe that the Earth is really flat. But 500 years ago, universities used to teach this, as well as the now disproven idea that the universe revolves around the Earth. Thanks to Copernicus and Galileo, established science was corrected. Today we teach still unproven ideas, such as the Big Bang Theory. Isn't it possible that, like those now debunked geocentric models, that perhaps other theories, like the Big Bang and even evolution itself, could one day be exposed as nonsense?
Well, you know, scientists realized at the beginning of the 20th century, that everything had been found to that date. Everything is done. We figured it all out.
Ah, did they really think that?
They really thought that.
Yet we're still employed. That's amazing.
And yeah, every time somebody develops a fundamental thing that's different, then everything changes.
Yeah.
And it's those little nubbins that cause the paradigm that makes a switch. And unfortunately, we've come over the years, scientists have come more towards applying their science rather than doing fundamental research, because there's not much money in fundamental research. So it's become slower and slower, but it still happens.
One of the things I teach my students is that most of the science that ends up in the chemistry, like 100-level chemistry books, was done in the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s. And it was usually done not as a consequence of someone's job, but rather as a consequence of someone's hobby. So it used to be the man cave thing to do, would be to go down and play with gold foil and try to push rays through tin foil and see if anything was on the other side. So the business of science has really been a 20th century phenomenon, and that I think feeds into Ed's statement that we're looking at application of science a lot more than we are looking at fundamental change.
Yeah. On the other hand, the physicists have been desperate to find something new, spending billions of dollars.
Yes.
And basically there's not been much in the last
50 years, maybe? Yeah, 50,
you are always willing to slap down quantum physics, aren't you? You always are ready.
The thing is that the revolutions in physics in the early 20th century, relativity and quantum theory, were so good that people have been nibbling around the edges of those since. Now, I mean, to their credit, you've got the standard model of quantum physics, which so far explains pretty much everything. And it's been very hard, I think, for the physicists to really find new things in the foundation of physics.
Is this a money issue? Are physicists doing this because the military-industrial complex shovels money to come up with anti-gravity, boys?
I mean, you look at the money, for example, that's gone into particle physics. They built the Large Hadron Collider at CERN and found the Higgs particle, which had been
theorized
before. And truthfully, not much else.
Okay. So do you want to talk about hot tubs or not?
We're
going to go to line two, and we'll talk to Diana about hot tubs. Diana, are you in Roxbury, New York, or Rockbury?
Well, it's the village of Denver and the town of Roxbury, New York.
Aha. Yes. Okay, yes. You're on.
Thank you for taking my call. So I am a nurse, and I have a science background, such that it is, including at a graduate level. So I understood from my chemistry courses that in your pH at the high level, it means is towards alkalinity, and the pH at the lower level is acidic. And yet I gave a hot tub, and there I measure, when I look at the balance of the water, there's a separate reading for pH and a separate reading for alkalinity, and there are separate chemicals for each. I don't understand why.
Okay. Oh. I see nods here.
I'm ready for this one. So pH is a measure of acid, particularly hydrogen ions, and that's all pH is. Alkalinity is a measure of carbonate and bicarbonate ions, and they're ones that resist pH change. So we call them buffers. And usually when you have an alkalinity reading, it's just carbonate and bicarbonate because those are very common weak bases that we add so that there won't be huge changes in pH if something happens, like rain gets in your hot tub. Say you leave the lid off and you have snow or rain that falls in. Snow or rain this time of year is really acidic. It's probably about 4, pH 4. And so it can really mess with your hot tub chemistry. So we keep these other additives in there so that you don't have big swings in pH in your hot tub, because that can really screw up everything else as far as, like, microbes can grow or you can lose some of the capacity to disinfect. So alkalinity is not necessarily, we're not looking at hydroxide ions, which is what you probably remember to be the base part of the acid base play. We're looking at carbonate and bicarbonate ions. Mm-hmm. Jim, did you want to add anything?
Nope.
That was very well said.
I teach water chemistry starting January 20th.
You got that, Diana?
Thank you. That was fabulous. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I appreciate that. I don't usually get that kind of accolade from my students.
Isn't that nice? Orin is in Pelham, Massachusetts. Hello, Orin in Pelham, Massachusetts. You're on.
Hello. Thank you. I was wondering, when you're in deep space, how do you tell north, south, east, west? What do you base it on?
You don't. It's up and down, and that's pretty well all that you've got. Unless you're using the Earth as a basic.
So there's no real directional information?
No, most people, I think, if they're in deep space, would argue that the two directions are towards the sun or away from the sun.
Oh, interesting.
Like our sun.
Like our sun, yeah. Because there's no there's no magnetic signal out there, so you can't use that to define your direction.
So basically, they use the stars. They just use the stars to navigate.
Right.
So you head. Okay. If a space probe is going to Jupiter, they know where to aim at and go, and there will be stars that will be.
So they navigate like the ancient sailors did then.
Yeah.
Basically.
Really interesting. All right, Orin, thanks a lot. Watch The Twilight Zone. They have the marathon every New Year's Eve on one of the channels. And some guy is in it. I think it's a classic sci-fi, Twilight Zone, and I won't give the surprise ending away. But the guy is in a spaceship. He's in a room, and he asks the computer, what time is it? The computer says, there is no time in space. That's got to be disconcerting, right? The guy said, just give me what time it is on Earth.
Yeah, and what time is it on Earth? It all depends on what time
where you are.
Earth.
Yeah.
In fact, there was talk about establishing a time zone for the moon.
Right.
Like different than UTC. So there's the universal time, which is Greenwich Mean Time, basically, and that's what a lot of the spaceships and GPS all kind of orient to the UTC time. But, you know, that still has a location on the planet, even though we use it. So we use it kind of as an artificial reference, but it's not really.
So we're plus 4 hours here.
Right. Plus
five
four
in daylight plus, savings.
Yeah, right.
All right. We only got 30 seconds here, but let's go to.
In Antarctica is UTC time, or is it Chilean time?
It's all the same time, whatever
it is. Right. The whole continent is one time zone. I know that.
All right, very quickly, Catherine and Sharon, Connecticut, you only have about 30 seconds to pose the question.
Okay, I received lovely steaks that were frozen and packed with dry ice.
Right.
And I am merely touching lightly, got a slight burn. Practically, how do I deal with dry ice? What is it?
Okay. You deal with it with gloves. And what it is frozen carbon dioxide. So minus 78 degrees Celsius. Have no idea
right,
what that is in Fahrenheit.
Minus 145 Fahrenheit.
And yeah, you can actually handle it if your fingers are very, very dry, but you really should handle it only with gloves.
Or just let it sit there for a couple of minutes till it evaporates.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Or if you're handling the meat that's been cold, that's been chilled by the dry ice. You know, again, handling it with gloves.
Even like a pot holder will work because you just need an air buffer between you and it.
Yeah.
Catherine.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
very much.
You got one of those Omaha steak gifts, huh? Nice for
nice.
Good for
yeah,
you.
Going to her house. For
it
lunch.
Wasn't Omaha. It was had to do with Yellowstone.
Oh, nice.
A lot of R's or D's or G's or something. Yeah. It was great. The ribeye, perfect.
I could talk steak with you all day, but alas, we're done, Catherine. Thank you, and thank you, scientists. Barbara Brabets, when do you get started again?
January 20th, our classes begin.
So you better party it up now, yeah?
Yeah, and get my stuff ready.
That too, I guess.
Yeah, I'm still sleeping, so I wouldn't know.
And you need more people for your class?
If anybody wants to come, they're welcome to come.
Well, don't you have to be enrolled in the college?
Well, most of them are.
We could make that happen.
Jim, what are you going to do?
I'm still trying to get some papers published.
Okay.
And I'll be dealing with that.
Yeah. Well, this was fun, and thank you all for being here, and we will do it again next month. Support comes from the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting Pine Bush Perspectives, a juried photo exhibit on display through February, both outside on the trail and inside the Discovery Center, albanypinebush.org. Once again, thanks to Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here today. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. Susie, thank you very much. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday, and we welcome back our good friend, Anissa Waheed. We'll find out what's going on with Anissa, talk a little Moroccan food and world cuisine. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.